Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour Podcast. We've got a loaded show for you today. Thanks so much for tuning in alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm Kevin Brown. Rosie, how are you feeling after two weekends, not just one week of championship series action?
Feeling good, feeling fired up, but feeling exhausted. That was a whole lot of lacrosse, but excellent games all around, top to bottom. Hard-hitting, fast-paced, all the stuff you know and love about some championship series lacrosse.
Are you feeling chaotic? Are you charging to the next weeks ahead? Well, what is your mindset moving forward?
Well done. Both of those things. I'm chaotically charging ahead, swinging my fists, closing my eyes.
We love a good adverb on this podcast. The New York Charging become the second Women's Lacrosse League Championship Series title winners. The Carolina Chaos win their first Championship Series title. We'll get into much of all of that and much more in all of this podcast. We have a very special guest, Carolina Chaos goalie Austin Kaut, which we'll get to in a few moments. But Rosie, I want to talk to you about the title game first, and we'll talk about the rest of the action. So Sunday was home to two exciting title games that really didn't end up too exciting at the finish. But the New York Charging, coming off a very vengeful semifinal win, and we'll get into more WLL stuff kind of later on in the podcast, but just as a cursory review for you listeners, I know you know all this already, but Izzy Skane, man, 6 goals, watching her in person never gets old. Just, Rosie, we were watching this game together, and she had a righty sweep where it was her hat trick, and it really sparked the kind of pull away run in the middle of the third quarter. And I gave you quite a Ryan Boyle reaction, where I was just like, oh, man, that was sick. Piping in, far pipe, near side. It was awesome for her to oblige for us and give us some close on-field action when she just totally dusted a defender and got underneath and a little crease dive action for her fifth in the fourth. New York Charging over the California Palms, who were quite a powerhouse going in. Any reactions from any of that nonsense that I just shouted out at you regarding Izzy Skane and her victorious teammates on the Charging?
Yeah, it is funny. Like, it can't really be said enough just how much of a monster Izzy Skane can be on a lacrosse field, right? You know, you got your good athletes and your great athletes, and then you just have your dominant ones. And this was a game that she just kind of took over at times, you know, like, you know, maybe there was some sort of, you know, we're not leaving anything on the table this time, you know, after making it to the championship last year and falling a little short against Boston. You know, maybe there's some of that motivation. But whatever it was that fueled them, they just kind of took things to a different gear, you know, and really kind of went to a place that California just wasn't willing to go at that time. You know, maybe caught them on their heels a little bit, both as far as, you know, intense scoring and things like that. The physical play has been discussed as well.
Physical play, indeed. we'll get to all of it, Rosie. It boiled over just before halftime. And boy, did it ever, if you saw the social media clips. But we'll start on the PLL side here, Rosie, and finish up with the WLL, because the Carolina Chaos came out on top. It was a tough fan to be from California, because you had two teams in the final on Sunday, and two teams come up short. The Redwoods going in, you know, I always see the, I always like to like revisit kind of pre-tournament, preseason expectations in Mario with what actually happened. The Redwoods, I thought, were the most complete roster of the PLL Championship Series. They played as such and were unbeaten to earn that bye straight to the final. Didn't play in the semifinal. I think that's now two straight years of that format that the team that has gotten the bye did not, that came up short. Fact check on me there. Is that correct? Boston Cannons over who last year? We'll edit this out, but it was...
Cannons beat Atlas last year.
Right, no, I think Atlas were the top seed.
It was the Archers. The Archers had the bye. Because they thought that that would help them beat the Cannons. They were like, oh, we were rested.
Right.
And they were wrong.
Because the big storyline behind that was... it was so great hearing from the, like, both Holmans, the player and coach, just, like, talk about, like, the crazy adrenaline rush that it's like, because it was still the weak sprint of, you know, you're playing, like, these crazy games and you don't have any rest, and these guys are just on the, in the trenches and in the recovery room, and they come up on top just by sheer force of will. This year, the Chaos get to collect themselves from an 0-2 start. They get to, you know, bounce back from a couple overtime losses. And, you know, not that they caught fire because they played their self-admittedly worst game in that semifinal. And it was funny hearing the contrast of post-game answers. And, you know, the Outlaws are like, yeah, we both played great. And it's like, well played to them. And, you know, they advanced. But we were right there with them. And Chaos were like, we played worse than we ever could have imagined. And I can't believe we were going through. So, you know, they get to the title game. And... Shane Knobloch, it was this year's Matt Campbell, and then some. 9 points to claim, and then some, the Golden Stick Award for the event's top scorer. His step back two was his step, his second two pointer. His first two pointer, just beautifully placed off hip, just laser. And, you know, he's got the crease dive going. He's just out athleting everyone when you've got that many defenders not used to playing on ball defense. Shane Knobloch is just like going to pick you apart. So, Rosie, Knobloch and the Chaos, just what did you take from their overall performance to come out of top?
You know, I think one of the elements that we saw from the Chaos was they had the ability to kind of score in a couple different ways, but it was really interesting the disparity in the size of their lineup. You know, you could roll out with, say, someone like a Ross Scott, who was very productive. You know, super shifty, figured out a way to put up 18 points throughout the series. But then you could also just as easily find yourself going up against a Cole Williams or a Charlie Bertrand or a Sergio Perkovic. And those guys, I mean, and those are just three. And then you start talking about like your Jackson Ikers of the group. And you would see at times, you know, somebody like a Perkovic could catch a pass almost like a power forward sort of thing. Just, you know, kind of extend the stick, catch it, and just kind of lower the shoulder and roll around you. They really found the way to highlight the disparity in the height and size that they brought against, say, a team like the Redwoods. You know, Redwoods do have great defensive presence. They, you know, we'd seen them put up a lot of great defensive efforts, but sometimes it just seemed like, you know, their lineup just wasn't really really key to match up one-on-one in those kinds of interior battles.
Yeah, especially defensively, right? You add in that kind of size on the sixes format, and, man, they can take up a lot of space in a hurry. And, you know, Rosie, looking at the end of series stats here, like, it's crazy that, you know, Matt Note, for any college fans, was a very formidable UMass goalie. He hasn't really gotten that, like, consistent of an opportunity with the Redwoods yet. But he really broke out, and he had 64 total saves. But that was 20 less than the leader, Austin Kaut, who will interview now. We now welcome on Carolina Chaos goalie, Austin Kaut. Austin, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate you having me.
Coming off a 2026 Championship Series title, we are delighted to have you on, Austin. So very humbled to have you join the show. I just want to read off a few numbers to you real quick. 16 saves, 25 saves, 17 saves. We'll skip the semifinal. Or, I mean, the last round. Yeah, it was the semifinal. 20 saves in the championship. Austin Kaut, how did you make so many saves during this championship series? And are you okay, man?
Yeah, I'm a little banged up. Feeling my age for sure. But, you know, I kind of said it, if you happen to see the after win press conference, I kind of said it a little bit in there. But going into this thing, I knew that you can't play a normal style of goalie play that you would try to do outdoor. It's not the same format. So I knew that I was going to go into it doing a couple different things, playing a different, you know, a little bit different of a style, you know, still sticking to my overall tendencies, but, you know, playing a little bit of a, you know, more aggressive style to make shooters be in a different difficult situation and have to make, you know, split second decisions in order to, you know, put the ball in the back of the cage. And it seemed like it worked out.
Yeah, just kind of carrying along with that a little bit, what was the prep like heading in? Did you kind of change up any sort of, you know, practice styles, or did you watch some clips of other champ series? How did you get ready for it?
Yeah, I mean, just there's not really any way to get ready for that style. I mean, it is not friendly to goalies, but, you know, it's great for the fan interaction, and what people get to see is scoring, high potency scoring, which is what you know, want to draw in more fans. So, you know, there wasn't much different to training for it, or, you know, watching film. It doesn't really help because guys are going to be doing different. It's going to be different players out there than it was in past. So it was more so about, you know, having a game plan and sticking to it that we did defensively. And it, like I said, it worked out in our favor.
The championship series is over, so you can divulge a little bit about the game plan that worked here, Austin. Just from one on an individual basis, what is playing a little more like aggressively and kind of are you baiting shooters a little more? Are you playing with a higher arc than maybe you're used to? And right, where the heck did that switch of hands come from, because we know that went viral on that night.
You know, the definitely higher of an arc at times, but more so changing it up depending on where the ball is and where the shot's coming from. So, you know, if the ball's in the center of the field, I'm definitely going to be coming out to take away some of the angle to make the shooter see less cage and make a better decision. You know, with the format of the ball going out of bounds and it's a turnover, guys tend to try to shoot not necessarily as perfect to the corners as they would in outdoor because they know they can get the ball back. So taking away more of that angle is I'm going to eat a couple more shots. You know, I'm going to put my body on the line knowing going into it that I'm going to have to do that to be successful. And, you know, some of the younger guys, you know, not to say that they're not in that frame, you know, mindset, but, you know, I definitely took a couple more shots in
the chest
or, you know, legs or, you know, anywhere you can be to, you know, to put our team in a situation to be successful. So it you know, worked out.
Who do you remember as giving you the most brutal shot you took?
sure who it was. I just know that, it was in the middle of the cage, and, you know, I go to match stick on stick and they shoot it down. It kind of catches me in the lower stomach. And every goalie knows when you go up, your chest protector comes up with you. So it just kind of hit me in the non-chest protector spot. And I took a couple in the, like, outside of the pec area that there's not really a chest protector on the outside. So kind of just, you know, is what it is. But, you know, put my body on the line for the team, so it was good.
That was going to be my next question, because, like, you know, you got to wear chest protectors. And if you're listening to this podcast, you've seen the clip of Austin in the post-game press conference showing the difference between sixes and full field lacrosse. And it's exactly that. You guys are going to see a lot of shots, the high volume. And, you know, we talked about your maybe differences in play style contrasting to the field. When it comes to defensively, your overall game plan, what do you think worked in terms of how much did you guys press? How much did you guys slide to help and recover? And what do you think proved the difference between, you know, coming so close in those first couple games and then going on that win streak?
The biggest difference, and it was the number one key that I wanted to stress on going into it. Never have played in the Champ Series, but seeing how the game progresses, it's the two-pointer. It really is defending the two-pointer. If you can take two-pointers off the board and make teams try to score 20 to 21 to 22 one-point goals, 90% of the time it's not going to happen. Like, it's not going to happen as long as you're still getting stops, you're still making saves. And then when in doubt, your offense can still put twos on the board and be in that situation. When you look at our first couple games, each team probably had one or two to three twos, which put us at like 26-24 or 24-25. And like, you're up in those numbers with those two-pointers. Whereas if you just limit those to ones, you're taking 3-4 points off the board and you're winning those games. It was definitely evident and more successful in that last round robin game. We held the Denver Outlaws to 0-2s, and it was definitely evident in that game that we came away with a good win there to get us in. And then, you know, the semifinal game, we got away a little bit, you know, whether it was fatigue or something like that, away from our game plan a little bit. And it was definitely up and back. You know, both goalies were trying to battle to make saves, and it was tough game in there. But, you know, it was a good bounce back on, Sunday that we really did only give up 1 2-point goal. And you can see the difference that if we give up another two, now that score is a lot tighter than where it was. So, you know, keeping those twos off the board is a huge piece to the overall strategy that I think most teams are going to start to do in the future, of just try to play good, solid one-on-one defense and, you know, make teams really beat you with 20 to 25 one-point goals and see if they can do it.
Austin, I want to ask you about kind of your career specifically. So, you know, for people who've been around the pro game and watched it for a long time, I don't think your performance over the championship series was that big a shock, right? Like, people have seen you, they've known what you're capable of. You know, the numbers don't lie. You know, Brooks, he mentioned it several times in the press conferences throughout the weeks. I think you're 8th overall, if I'm not mistaken, as far as career saves, things like that. But, you know, this particular time, you get the roughly 2 weeks where you're the man in the cage every minute throughout the entire time. So, you know, if you just got to pro lacrosse, like, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, you might be like, you know, wow, where's this guy coming from? You know, how did it feel to kind of be in front in the spotlight all this time consistently through a whole tournament?
Yeah, I mean, it takes me back a little bit, because obviously I haven't been around in a different aspect for the Chaos. You know, my role is a little bit different for the Chaos, you know, in supporting, you know, who truly is the best goalie in the world, Blaze. You know, that's my role for the Chaos, and it was good to, you know, have a little bit of a different role and be a little bit more of a leader than I try to be on the, you know, during the summer. And it was, taking me back a little bit to times where I was, you know, the guy in cage, you know, and, you know, I love every second of what I do to support plays and anything I can do to help the team get better during the season. But it was great to be back in there between the pipes, you know, for, you know, a good amount of time. Now, in the Sixers format, you know, we'll see. I mean, that's just not fun. But at the same time, it was good to be in there, see the volume of shots. The strategy that I had going in there worked. So it was good.
Austin, pre-recording, you brought up a great story that I want to hit on next in terms of, you know, the post-game scenes after you break the single-game record for saves of 25. But before I do, I think, was it that game or the next game? I think it was the one of 17 saves, your first game against Denver where you switched hands. One, Rosie and I were debating. Just to let you in a little bit behind the scenes here, how impressive do you actually think that was? Because the internet was like freaking out. Rosie and I were like, listen, that's pretty cool. But like, you made both saves with what? You're like your feet and like your lower body. And take us through why you even switched hands in the first place.
I mean, I had had this conversation with Brooksy, I had this conversation with Spencer. I had this conversation, with, you know, JC, you know, our backup,
former IL in the
Champ Series.
JC Igamon.
Yeah. And I told him, I said, you're going to see some stuff that is not normal goalie play. Don't think this is normal because it's not going to be, but I'm going to play with guys' minds. You know, when they're doing, you know, film and everything like that. Hey guys, you know, it's a lefty goalie, you know, where's the ball going to need to go? So it's burned in their brain that they're seeing a lefty goalie. So when I knew that there was going to be a couple different breakaways or, you know, drives underneath left-handed, that if I have to watch a lefty come from down and he's coming across me, I know that he's got this whole side of the cage. So why not just put it there? Maybe he throws it right in there. So when I saw the breakaway coming, I said, what a perfect opportunity. I stayed left. Soon as he caught the ball and turned towards me, I went to my right. And now he's got to make a split second decision of like, what do I do now? So regardless, who knows if it was in my left hand, I probably don't make the save because I probably don't step the same way. So, you know, putting it in my right hand just made them second guess themselves. And he decided to still shoot it in that area. So I knew I was stepping to my stick side because I know it's protecting the right. Knowing that he thinks I'm a lefty. Then, you know, as soon as I make the save, rebound goes out, I'm going to go back to my strong hand because I know that that's going to be better suited for me if I need to just play mind games with somebody. And it worked out again. Played the mind games, made a guy miss, you know, happened to throw the foot out and make the save. So, you know, it just was something that I did. Even though it caught the body, I still think it was, you know, the right thing to do, just making guys play mind games so that they don't just come running down and just throw a ball right in the gauge.
Absolutely. You almost think it's like, why don't goalies do that more often? Yeah, you
play. I think some of them would get benched if they tried to do that in regular games. You know, I already got tagged in a couple videos of a Hopkins goalie doing it in practice. I already got tagged in a couple other videos of guys trying to do it in
coaches are hating you right now.
They are because they're gonna be really angry at that. Now, if the younger generation starts to tag onto it, I mean, I don't know if you've seen some of the videos from Chaos Practices. Like, it is a major thing that I do as a scout goalie that if we're playing a ready goalie, I'm playing practice right-handed. Like, I don't come back to my left hand. It doesn't matter if I get lit up. Doesn't matter if I make saves. I'm showing our offensive personnel a righty goalie in cage. So they need to see and be prepared for what they're going to see on the weekend. Now, I will toot my own horn a little bit. I'm making saves. I'm making stick saves. I'm making body saves. I'm like, it's pretty good. And sometimes I say when you're in your strong hand, you kind of rely on like, knowing that you can get your stick to certain areas. So you like kind of cheat things and you can get back. When it's in my right hand, you come back to true goalie techniques of wait and react, and sometimes it's a little bit cleaner and better than what it would be in your strong hand. So it's because your strong hand, like I said, you kind of anticipate and cheat a little bit just because you know you can get back if you don't get it. And when you're in your off hand, you really got to go back to your basic principles of like waiting and reacting for the shot to come.
So the origin story for it was like champ series specific. You were, it just kind of popped in your head where you're kind of like, you know what, this might be the time to break this out.
Yeah, I mean, I knew that I was going to do it just because of righties going down the righty alley. If I would, I've done it. I did it a couple times that like you didn't catch on film, just to kind of make guys think about it. But righties down the righty alley, like they got all that cage to look at. Why not just put it in my right hand and make them think about it and miss the cage? Like, once again, missing the cage is a win for the defense in this. So it was just, like I said, different play, different style, trying to, you know, toy with shooters' minds and make them think about a couple things.
No, it is so interesting to think about with the, you know, it's a different discipline and you have to have these innovative approaches to the game. And it's only the only way that we're going to improve collectively, you know, if we stand any chance of beating Team Canada in the LA 28.
Exactly. Who knows? You know, I'm waiting for the call. You know, I'm waiting for the call to get an opportunity to join that training camp. We'll see.
Hey, that performance, I'm not like, that was said in like half jest, I think, but like the save totals are like that. That is why I led with it. It is pretty outstanding. I haven't done my due diligence research to compare it to years past, but it is pretty crazy to get more than a couple 20-plus save performances. And do you think so I was about to ask if splitting weekends helped, but having not been there during the week sprint of the Champ Series. So just to pivot, like, losing your first two games, what did it take for you guys to, all right, let's collectively reset here, still all in front of us, to go on and win the title? Because it was just, it was crazy that it was two pipe shots and overtime and rebounds that did you in ultimately. And so you're right there. It was that kind of the message in the locker room, like, hey, yeah, you were, I mean, right in those two games.
We went into leaving Sunday and we had a team film session on Tuesday night, everybody on Zoom, to kind of go through and basically just like take a deep breath and like reset that when you looked at every other team that had two games already, they blew one team out and then got blown out. Like, if you look at the scores, they beat one team handedly, and then they got beaten handedly by the other team. We were the only team that was in each game and didn't get blown out and didn't blow somebody out. But that doesn't mean we weren't scoring. We just didn't get blown out. So we knew that we were right on the verge of doing the right things in order to make us successful. It came together full circle for that Denver game. Game plan worked. We locked it down, got it done, got the win. And then, you know, running it into that semifinal game, we knew we were right on the same spot going back to playing the same. We knew it wasn't going to be the same game. You know, we knew it was going to be a tougher game. We knew it was going to be a dog fight. So it ended up being that way. You know, my lowest saves, it was probably like 7 or 8. You know, it was definitely not great coming off of that. But, you know, the fact that we were able to, you know, again, reset from that. You know, I had a conversation with Blaze after that game. He said he watched the film and he's like, there's not much really you can do when, you know, the shots that we want to see are falling. Like, you know, they were doing a good job of hitting a pipe and in, or, you know, getting underneath and getting to the middle of the field where, like, every once in a while I'd make one of those saves. I wasn't catching them that time. And then they would hit a pipe and in, or they would spike one at my feet and it would go up underneath the crossbar. You know, at certain points, it was just tough to, like, kind of get into a rhythm, obviously, defensively for us. So then offensively, they were doing the same thing and doing a really good job of keeping us in it. So the offense carried us that game. But then going into the championship game, like being able to, as a team, set our sights what we wanted to do, get back to the game plan. We switched up a couple things defensively so that we would show them a little bit new of a look, but still put them in a situation to shoot shots that I wanted to see as a goalie. And it worked out again. So it was great.
The perfectly leading into this, you just mentioned the championship game. Right after it's over, how do you guys celebrate? Does everybody kind of have the time to stick around? Is everybody on planes right away? What'd you guys do?
Yeah, I mean, it was good. It was a good celebration, team celebration in the locker room. You know, obviously you got to drink out of the cup. You know, it was great to have, you know, be able to actually take that deep breath and share that moment with your teammates of the hard work that you put in over the last 2 weeks was all worth it. You know, time away from girlfriends, time away from families, time away from, you know, normal work. You know, some guys have full-time jobs that they're kind of, you know, pushing that work off on the side to focus on games. And, you know, all that time away, you know, was finally paid off, and you got to raise that cup at the end. So the celebration was great in the locker room. You know, and then I think Coach Brooks kind of, you know, was able to have the guys over to, you know, after that to really finish out the celebration. I unfortunately wasn't there. I'm right back in the car, you know, after a couple hours, and just get myself home to my wife to make sure that I'm back here to give her a break from our 4 month old. So, but it was good to enjoy that time with the team. And, you know, there's still a lot of work to be done, even though that's a great, you know, achievement for us right now. It's the first step into a bigger picture that we need to look forward going into the 2026 summer season.
Well, what's that drive home like for you when it's just kind of you and what's going on there?
Me, my thoughts, a couple different phone calls, you know, to Blaze, to Troy, to, you know, other guys on the team that, like, you know, were always, you know, watching us the whole entire time, calls to my family, you know, and then just kind of soaking in the overall, like, you know, we did it. Like I said, it was worth the body pains, the everything that we went through. So it was an enjoyable 2.5 hour ride home, you know, to get back to reality for me.
Get you a man that can do both. Oh my goodness, Austin. So you mentioned pre-recording here. I alluded to it. You're 4 month-old, 4 month-old daughter Palmer. We can hear a little bit in the background there. So God bless you for sticking with us a little bit longer. Just a few more questions. But you mentioned just the hilarious scenes of, you know, after your record game of saving 25 shots in a sixes style is crazy. And just tell us a little bit more about how much it meant to share that moment with your daughter.
Yeah, I was glad that my wife brought her down to come to that game on Sunday, and not the outcome that we wanted. You know, obviously would have liked to have a win with that, you know, record as well. But, you know, it was kind of crazy. I didn't even really know until I saw my wife after the game. She goes, "Did you know that you broke the save record?" I was like, "I don't even know what that is. Like, what was it?" Like, I had no clue. I know that I played a decent game, but, you know, it was pretty surreal to then, you know, be able to hold my daughter on the field in my jersey. It was the main reason why I wanted to continue to play. I mean, after that performance, it seems like I could probably play for another couple years, but, you know, we'll see where, you know, my body takes me over the next, you know, summer at least. You know, the funny story about that was, you know, the first thing I saw was my wife and daughter after the game, and I looked up in the stands, I saw her, and my wife came down to the railing, and I was like, "All right, well, give her over." So I stood up on a cooler, she handed her down to me, and then, you know, it was awesome that, you know, ESPN had caught that moment with me and my daughter on the field and kind of talking to her, and I hadn't seen her in a couple of days. So the first time I was away from her for a couple of days. So it was a great moment that ESPN caught that moment with me and her on the field. You know, I got a picture with her, but, you know, come full circle, we get back to, you know, championship Sunday, and my wife's at home watching the game, and ESPN broadcasts her hanging the baby over the railing to give her to me. And my wife kind of sent a video like, "Oh my goodness, I'm on national television hanging my baby over a railing." So, you know, it was a kind of a funny scenario. She was safe as can be, but, you know, just a funny experience that my daughter will now have for, you know, her life, that she gets to see where she was at 4 months and, you know, what her father was doing out there.
Your response could have been, listen, I was saving everything, man.
Yep, exactly. I wasn't dropping her for sure.
You know, so you mentioned, you know, playing a few more years. I think you totally could based on what we've seen here. But in these recent couple months and, you know, couple years, you know, we've seen some leadership changes. Now you've got Brooksy as your head coach, Spencer Ford as a general manager, and your assistant coach for this time. What has it been like so far, not only getting back to the format of having a GM and a coach as two separate roles, but now kind of looking forward to the future, having those guys in particular doing it?
You know, Spencer Ford is one of the great minds of this sport. And, you know, Brooksy had given him a shout out in our post-game press conference that he had built this team before Brooksy got here. So, you know, the pickups of, you know, Bertrand Scarpello. And then, you know, we've added Cole Williams late last year. And, you know, some of our other veterans coming back are huge pieces, Brendan Nickturn as well, you know, having those pieces get added for our Champ Series roster, but then for our regular season is unbelievable and unmatched. We have a great group of guys that's super close knit. And then adding, you know, Coach Brooks to basically steer us into the 2026. It was Champ Series and now into the 2026 season. We couldn't ask for a better situation for the chaos, you know. As we kind of said, there's a new era of chaos coming, you know, into this 2026 season, and it's exciting to see. So couldn't be happier to be a part of this group and to have those guys, you know, as our leadership.
Austin, you've been super generous with your time with us here. Just leave us off with just that, right? Your comment there. This is a new era of chaos lacrosse. What does this momentum do for you guys going into 2026 summer?
Yeah, gives a little bit of confidence, shows that we can handle tough situations in games, which we're going to be in this upcoming season. Two extra games now. There's 12 regular season games. So, you know, it's definitely going to be a grind throughout the summer that we're going to be in those tough situations. And, you know, we've always said closer locker rooms, you know, are going to win those games. And I think we have one of the closest locker rooms around. So, you know, I would put it up against any. And, you know, I think this shows and proves a point that we can, in those tight games, come together and really pull them out. So,
awesome. Congrats again, man. Appreciate you joining the show, and can't wait to see you guys compete again this summer here.
Thanks a lot.
That was a great conversation with Austin. With a four-month-old and all, just taking some time to be a man for the people, really, and get the fans what they want. Some great insights. Rosie, what would you take away from that Cal interview?
I loved hearing him break down the mentality behind, you know, the switching hands. You know, I also loved that he was able.
I gave him a little too much grief on that one.
I think you did. I thought he was going to push back at you a little bit.
He kind of did. He turned his own horn, which I wanted.
That is a good way to do it. He brought receipts because he was like, you know, well, I made the saves. Because you were kind of like, how impressive is it really? So, you know, he
it was just a pushback against the whole internet, be like, oh my God, like, this is the greatest thing lacrosse goalie's ever done. It was really awesome. Awesome. And the breakdown was even better because of the fact that he's playing mind games with these guys.
I loved that he acknowledged how much of it was mental. You know, mental battles against these other guys. You know, you're in a cramped space. It's super quick. A lot of these guys are getting these crazy fast breaks that they've never seen on a lacrosse field before. And it's just, you know, them versus the goalie. So he kind of leveled the playing field to the best of his ability. You know, obviously it's still such a super offensive oriented game. But he, you know, he did what he could to kind of tip the scales in his favor a little bit, which is kind of, you know, getting the mentality of the shooter, or maybe get him to second guess sort of thing. You know, we saw a lot of that this series. You heard Romar talking about it, interestingly enough, against Austin Kaut, where, you know, he almost won their game in regulation, but Austin just kind of easily just grabbed his shot. It was a high, and there was nothing to him, you know. But then Romar remembered that and came back with something else. A lot more chess move mentality to this thing than I think a lot of people understand.
Was he shooting 110 miles per hour with his left hand? Because it surely would have went in. No. Romar, Dennis, I think, you know, even fighting through some injuries earlier in the series, had, what, like a pretty great performance. Only 2 1-point goals in the title game. But again, you heard from Austin right there that was such a game plan of theirs to take away the two. And, you know, Romar had a nice overtime winner. So nowhere really near the golden stick form that he showed a few years back, but still an interesting collection of roster players for this California team. Just to follow up short, 24-16 is the final in this one. And, you know, Rosie, we'll get to your pre-pod takeaway in a sec here, because I think it was really interesting. The spread of wealth on this California team was kind of fascinating to follow. Only one true lefty, Mikey Boehm, was really running out there every offensive possession, along with Andrew McAdory, who was kind of leading the offensive charge. And if you saw him play sixes, then you would know why, because he's such a jitterbug that he can beat any on-ball defender he wants. So, you know, credit to Chaos and other defenses for not letting him explode for even more points. But Aiden Denza was, without a doubt, the breakout star for this Redwoods team. Anthony Kelly said it best after the title game, where he was like, there's so many guys just prefacing that Aiden Denza is a role player first. And no, he's a stud midfielder. Like, he's an athletic ACC alum midfielder that can put up points in this pro league. So I thought that was really interesting, because he's always been a fourth, fifth option in his Duke days. Add him to a shorter shot clock, give him the most touches on some nights for this California team in the Champ Series format, and he is really productive. He does the fundamentals really well, shoots overhand, high to low shots, and can score with both hands. So, but Rosie, what was your takeaway for the listeners here? Because I thought it was really interesting.
Big takeaway from the California Redwoods during the championship series: the lack of touches for our boy Dylan Malloy, 2023 Champ Series champion. We've seen the way he produced during the season. You know, seemed to be highly favored heading in to be a, you know, major player in that offense. You know, granted, we did see, you know, Denenz and McAdory step up big, but just the numbers looking at it here, 49 touches in 4 games for Dylan Malloy. Now, just relative to some other guys, you know, if you're looking at other teams, Fulton Bayman had 77, Justin Anderson had 102. Looking at his own team, well, Romar had 89, like 40 more touches than Dylan Malloy had. Aiden Denenza and Andrew McAdory had almost 100 more each than Dylan Malloy.
That's crazy.
Yeah, 144 for Denenza, 142 for McAdory. And, you know, look, they were hot, don't get me wrong, right? They're putting up a bunch of points, you know, so sometimes you do have to let them cook in those situations. But it is surprising to see just how little Malloy was involved on that side of the ball. You know, the final game, that championship game, he had 7 touches, which is basically like defense. You know, there were, I think, 2 guys with fewer on the team, and they were the guys you would assume, you know, like pure defenders.
Yeah.
So weird shift in roles for him heading forward there.
I want to shine some light on the other couple teams that finished last in the standings here. But before I do, anything that we missed here with chaos in Redwoods storyline narrative-wise coming away from the Champ Series? We'll get to some players who impressed, and I think it was more for these next two teams who were actually in the 2025 actual title game, and players who can maybe crack rosters elsewhere. But from a sheer championship series outlook standpoint, like, you know, you and I were chatting on, all right, well, or some things we can write about coming away from this. And, you know, to me, it still seemed like the effects of the first championship series in 2023, the Chrome winning, right? Romar Dennis went off, was his, if I have the timeline correct, was his, like, really, like, crazy Champ Series breakout where he was like, all right, I'm just going to sling it from two and you guys can't stop me.
Right.
The next year, teams just, like, started pressing as it went on. And, you know, the Boston Cannons came out on top. Matt Kavanaugh in the clutch, right? And then Matt Campbell led the Cannons to last year's Champ Series where everyone was full court pressing the whole time. So this year, my main takeaway holistically was like, all right, taking away the two is still a priority, but there wasn't nearly as much transition coming away from the first game as I thought there would be. And maybe that was a byproduct of this first game being the second highest scoring Champ Series game ever to be played. Denver Outlaws beating the Atlas 32-22. So 54 total scores in that one. Terry Foy laughed at my line in the recap where I was like, yeah, transition defense was optional. There was a lot of goals. Rosie, you think that's a fair assessment of the style of play overall?
Yeah, I think so. I think the thing that we're kind of seeing, and it kind of changes year by year when we kind of get more of a sample size and, you know, more teams participating for the first times or bringing different rosters, is we really kind of see to what degree, you know, it's the style or to what degree it's kind of the fighters involved in the fight, you know? Mm-hmm. So heading into this, I was really curious to see, like, who is going to be the two-point shooter? Because last year, two-point shooting numbers were down. But, you know, when you look at the teams that were in it, you know, you see, like, the Archers, and maybe they have a lot of guys who don't classically do that kind of thing. And, you know, we didn't have, say, a Romar in it, you know, or that kind of thing as well. So, but then this year, you know, the numbers go back down again. And I think probably we've probably seen enough to think maybe it is more of a product of teams kind of adjusting or playing out appropriately and also deciding what is and isn't a good shot, which I think maybe they're also kind of valuing, you know, when it's a better time to go for a one. And, you know, sometimes we do see some two-pointers that, you know, end up just kind of looking ridiculous in a, you know, a transition opportunity where maybe you should have gone for a one with a couple more steps, but instead you missed the whole cage and you turn the ball over right away. So I think one of the coolest parts about the championship series is it's still so young that mm-hmm. we're always seeing this evolution, you know, every time out there. You know, we're always learning something new about it. But yeah, definitely, like you're saying, the transition game defense was not something that was mandatory each and every time out.
I think it was after that first night. You know, like, no team got a 30 burger right after opening night. So that's an improvement.
Yeah.
But yeah, it is very much like, who's your fighter? Who do you have on your roster that can do this? Because the pre-series prognostication, looking at these Atlas and Outlaw rosters, who these 12 guys that they can bring based on the NLL and college coaching unavailabilities, you know, they're going to be shorthanded. And these are the two teams that are bringing the most ringers, and we're going to keep an eye on, see if any of them will resign anywhere else. But it's, you know, it's interesting that the Atlas beat Chaos in overtime. I didn't get great eyes on that one. Miles Jones, I think, did he have the winner? It was off the post, and then someone scored.
Kyle Jackson. I've got him scoring with 28 seconds left.
Right, right, because that was the funny context, because he kind of got in that shoving match with Bundy, and next night he gets the OT winner. So, you know, a little NLL grit translating to the Champ Series game. Another guy, like Charlie Bertrand, like deserves a shout out for the Chaos Squad, because he was really fantastic all series long. But yeah, Rosie, what were your impressions from the New York and Denver squads and coming away from this?
Well, yeah, it was really funny to see that game in particular, New York and Denver, kind of kick things off, because, you know, everybody sits down looking at that game with one team, New York, which is, you know, they did bring in some newcomers, but essentially it's a known quantity, right? Like, we thought we should know what to get, you know, from Miles Jones or Brian Costable. We've seen them in this format before. Or even like Kyle Jackson, we've seen him perform in a similar sort of way. You know, his game out in the field is very similar to his game in the box, which, you know, you should think is also very similar to his game in sixes. So I felt like heading into this game, we all had a pretty good idea of what to expect. And then, at least as far as I'm thinking, Denver totally shakes everything up after that first night. You know, just they're just dropping two-pointers left and right. You know, you're getting Justin Anderson with 9 points in that game. You know, they're just shooting from everywhere. And I leave that first day thinking, oh, okay, you know, this super huge question mark roster, that's the Denver Outlaws, you know, they've actually got something really powerful here. It turns out that they kind of, I think maybe they kind of ran out of gas after that first game. And
then that second game. Or after, you're right.
Yeah, after that first one. I think they, you know, maybe they had their foot on the gas a little too much in that first game. And then we never quite saw that performance from them again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but that's, I guess, a lesson for the championship series, right? You know, maybe the first impression isn't necessarily the one that's going to stick the whole time. It's a lot of learning in a very compressed and short time. Everybody has to adjust very quickly.
Well, I was trying to think of who this Carolina Chaos team parallels almost exactly, right? The losing the first two games part, then catching fire and losing their next four or three games. Was that the Chrome that first year that they lost the first two? And then I think so, right? Like
opening night, Chrome lost an overtime one to the Archers. And then the following night lost 29-20 to Atlas. So,
and
yeah.
Rosie, who did the Chrome become?
The Denver Outlaws.
Oh, there's the connection, baby. Not quite, because it was the Carolina Chaos who ended up doing it at the time. But, you know, the Denver Outlaws were involved. Justin Anderson was on that Champ Series team. And listen, it's crazy to think Dylan Malloy was on that Champ Series team as well. Anyways, coming away from this one, there are a handful of players who impressed, and, you know, they signed championships series only contracts, but where are the rosters that will actually utilize them in the summer? Rosie, there's a schedule change that we haven't discussed on this podcast where there's a couple more regular season games. Let's go. Moving up into May, NCAA tournament time. It's also PLL opening weekends time in 2026. 12-game schedule instead of a 10-game schedule this year. Who are some players who signed championship series? Give us the full list if you have it still up.
I do believe I have the full list right here. Let's see here real quick. Go through it here. Zach Vigue, Kyle Jackson, Brian Phipps, Miles Jones, Eric Malver, Jack Corris, Dylan Gerger, J.C. Higginbottom, Lance Madonna, Fulton Bayman, Ryan Cohen. That might be it.
So Brian Phipps, legend of the game, veteran, didn't see any of them. J.C. Higginbottom deserves a shot on a roster and will eventually come into a game and everyone's going to be like, wow, this former Bellarmine guy is like sick. How did this happen? Because, you know, he faced a very high volume of shots in his college days and is prepared to do so at the pro ranks as well. But for the guys who actually got some impact time in this champ series, like, you know, Kyle Jackson is a very known quantity that was beat out of that lefty spot on a championship winning team by Reed Bowering. And, you know, if anyone needs a lefty to pair out of the box, go with their lefty attackman who can kind of be a utility player and go off the wings of faceoffs. If you got a good faceoff guy with 32 second shot clocks, any team ring a bell with a guy who can make that kind of impact for you?
Well, you know, especially based on the way that you laid it out, just kind of introducing it, you may not necessarily look to sign a guy with the belief that he's going to be your start to finish every weekend starter, right? So if you need perhaps like a sort of a shifty lefty attackman, maybe a team like the Carolina Chaos might need somebody early in the year. They might have some NLL obligations with a guy like an Owen Hiltz playing attack for them who may not be available the whole time. So, you know, I could definitely see Kyle Jackson getting the call to reunite with his old Chaos squad, previously won a championship with them. You know, I certainly think he showed quite a bit during this series. So, yeah, I mean, that's the first team that jumps off to my mind for him.
Fulton Bayman was the guy that I think us media members were talking about most on the sidelines in terms of his pop was outstanding all series long. And he's just got the best comeback story of any player with all the ACL injuries he had at Notre Dame. He has this breakout, awesome season, realizing his full potential at Georgetown as a grad transfer. And, you know, coming into a pro league undrafted, let's see what you can do. Tim Sudan gives him all the confidence. Like, look, you can dodge these guys. Like, you're used to dodging poles. Dodge some short sticks without any slide, and you'll get underneath or get your shot topside. And Bayman did just that, and he was superb. I just do not know what team could use him as an invert option coming out of the box. It'll be clearer once we're coming closer to the season and we know more of the unavailabilities of each roster. But he is definitely a player to look out for. Rosie, do you have another?
Well, yeah, we definitely have to talk about Miles Jones. Where does he go from here? You know, it was interesting to see him sign in the sort of short-term championship series only deal. But also, he had kind of essentially been phased out of that lineup up in New York.
Another Reed Bowering casualty.
Yeah, so, you know, I think he demonstrated that he has the ability to continue playing and, you know, he's got the vision, still can get it done. Kind of just needs a spot. Where could he potentially go? I'm very interested to see, assuming, of course, he doesn't go back to New York. And it always seems like we're still at the stage where a lot of it comes down to player comfort, right? So, I mean, mm-hmm. maybe he doesn't even want to leave. I don't know. If he does want to go somewhere and maybe get a shot at being an everyday starter, I mean, not to just, you know, pick the same team again for no reason, but does he also reunite, head back to Carolina? You remember when the player movement opened the first time, he went on Instagram and posted a picture of himself in a Carolina Chaos uniform. Just, I don't know why he did that, but he did that.
Give us more of those confusing messages, please.
Absolutely.
We want
more.
Throw
the people for a loop. So, yeah, I mean, does it actually get done this time around, you know? I mean, he like I said, he demonstrated that he can still play here. So maybe a team like Carolina wants to look at their roster and they say, you know what, we could use some more big guys and just add him into the mix.
Rosie, Shane Abla came up with the Golden Stick Award winner. You had an idea that we forgot to bring up to Kaut because I think he was actually probably the best candidate, maybe, or the top overall player. Can you explain your the award that you hypothetically would have given out?
I can, but I won't because I'm going to write about it.
Teaser! What a tease.
So, very soon, we will elaborate on that.
you'll know when you see it.
Yep, I'll get around to it very soon.
All right, just to finish up on the PLL side, Rosie, as I think this will dovetail nicely into a pretty remarkable women's side of the championship series event. The schedule going ahead is adding two games to the regular season. I caught up with co-founder and president Paul Rabel about all the changes in a pretty open and transparent interview you can read on insidelacrosse.com. And, you know, from just the schedule impacts and their overall mindset of not wanting to compete with NFL in the fall, which fans have been clamoring for years whenever the PLL postseason wraps up and it's like week three of the NFL. So that overlap is still in place for this year, but it is a goal of theirs to get rid of in the short term future. The goal for in implementing local owners for all eight teams, and we'll see if we can get that in the near term future as well. The desire to add general managers to each team that has a head coach. We have Spencer Ford, Dave Cottle now with Bill Tierney, and the last general manager is
Spallina.
Joe Spallina joining Anthony Kelly last offseason as well. Trader Joe, as we know. And listen, the major offseason news of re-signing a major media rights extension, really, with ESPN, a 5-year deal for the broadcast rights is huge, and it brings about new investment opportunities and new investment into their players and bump in salary caps and player compensation. And that turns into some fun stories to cover when it comes to free agency, and that was the case when Gavin Adler, the reigning defensive player of the year, who has made some fiery remarks on this very podcast the last two seasons, decided to switch teams to the Philadelphia Water Dogs with an experienced negotiator like Dave Cottle, joining Bill Tierney. And, you know, Mike Pressler, coaching is his It's his strength. And Gavin Adler wasn't very pleased with the fact that a deal wasn't done and he reached the stage of free agency. So I thought that takeaway was very interesting to learn about. And, you know, he signs with the Water Dogs, and just hear the behind the scenes whispering of, yeah, it's like, all right, well, Brian Costabile is our other marquee free agent, and he's getting this like max offer from the Redwoods, who have all this open cap space that they try to get Jared Bernhardt at the beginning of last season anyway. So let's see if anyone can lure away into the forest that is the Woods. So far, no luck for Joe Spoelstra, because again, Mike Pressler matches it. He ended up matching it with Gavin Adler, but it was a little too late in the process. So we'll keep track of some more of those stories as free agency goes along. But I think it dovetails nicely into the WLL side of things, because they are having their first full season, and there is more expansion on the horizon for them. You know, they're starting out in the Providence weekend, which is the week two for the PLL side. So May 15th and 16th out in Rhode Island. So it's a site that the PLL has never been before, which I thought was a cool quote from Rabel explaining that side of things. It's like, let's have the women have like their own like big weekend, right? Like, it's a whole new realm of possibilities. And Rosie, over to you. Just, we heard a lot of optimism, right, from the WLL press conferences. There was only one winner, but every team that showed up to their last press conference was pretty ecstatic that they can go back to battle with their friends in a couple months here.
Right. Yeah. It's a whole different animal now that they've established that there's going to be a league this summer. It's not so much that you just have these 2 weeks where you play and then, you know, you lose and you say, okay, well, I'll see you later. And are they on the same team? Yes. But if you don't really have anything for another 50 weeks, what good is a team really even, you know, I mean, maybe you'll have a group chat going or something like that, but you're not working for a common goal. Everybody has different plans in the spring and the summer and all that time off. Then you'll just get back together, play in the championship series, and that'll be fun and great, but it'll have more of a reunion sort of vibe than, you know, just another step in your team, right? And so the way they have it set up now moving forward is it is just like, it's almost just like what the men have on the PLL side. You know, there's going to be this event, and they'll plan for the championship series, and they'll plan out their strategies and their rosters and everything accordingly. And when that's done, they turn the page and start planning towards the summer. And, you know, the coach/GMs were already talking about, you know, we're going to have this draft coming up. You know, Lori DeLuca from the Boston Guard was already saying, you know, I think midfield is going to be a big look for us coming up in the college draft. You know, they've got to add people to all of their rosters because obviously you need more players going 10v10. So, you know, it's a brand new sort of ball game that just instantly shifted for these whole organizations. Now they mean a lot more. They're more of a legit sort of thing year round. And, you know, it's a huge change.
A huge change indeed. And the momentum built off a second consecutive successful championship series tournament. This time, you know, big picture wise, Rosie, to me, it's really fortunate for them to come into this having Charlotte North leading the Boston Guard in a like headline heavy inaugural champ series. Then for her to win the Golden Stick Award, great. But for Izzy Skane to lead the charging, those are the two biggest names in the sport on the women's side right now. And for them to both be going into the first full season of WLL action, I think is immense from a narrative standpoint and all the kind of marketing that you can do from that, right? So big picture wise, like the star power, we have it. And the infusion of talent, aside from just North and Skane, like Allie Kennedy just immediately raising the Maryland charm to be pretty darn hard to beat, albeit they finished last. And Listen, like players, the infusion of talent was my biggest takeaway from year one to year two, although there were some kind of big names that weren't able to play in the champ series, like, you know, rookie Fallon Vaughn, Bell Smith from last year was released actually. So interesting storylines that we'll monitor, but Rosie, the star power going in the first full year, just how important will that be?
Yeah, I think that's going to be huge. And one sort of thing that I thought was, you know, is it important for the league? Maybe, maybe not. But I think it really shows the potential that it isn't all just on Charlotte's shoulders. You know, like she is tremendous. She is fantastic. Gold, you know, championship last year, Golden Stick this year. But something I noticed being at the St. James all the time was the jerseys you saw. It wasn't just Charlotte North jerseys, which I thought was really encouraging for the growth of the league as a whole. You know, I saw a bunch of kids in Ally Mastriani jerseys. I saw some Abby Bosco jerseys, you know, Sydney Black jerseys. It's not just
the Moreno ones. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you have to feel a little bit better knowing it's not a situation where not only is everybody going to watch if Charlotte North is playing, but, you know, maybe not watch a Palms Charm game or something like that, right? You know, have right. enough talent, and when people learn more about it, they can say, you know, have different reasons to tune in, you know? So, I mean, that's, I think, a really encouraging sign moving forward. You're definitely going to have your diehard Charlotte North fans or your Izzy Skane fans, but I think it's important to the growth of the league. And, you know, when they're making this first impression moving forward as the full field, full summer model, that there's going to be all sorts of talent in addition to a super huge megastar like a Charlotte or an Izzy, who are both really good at being, you know, super huge megastars. They're good with the crowds and, you know, people wanting their, you know, wanting their attention or their autographs or all that stuff. They seem to be doing a really good job being thrown into that role. But it's also good to see that there are a bunch of other people who can step up, take on some of that load as well.
The other main takeaway I had from the WLL side is the goaltending was absolutely incredible. Madison Doucette led everyone with 51% in net, 66 saves as well, was the leader in that category, and for good reason, that she led New York to the title. And she was so consistent. And just the point blank stuffs was pretty phenomenal. The physicality in the championship series title game was a big talking point that we alluded to in the early parts of this podcast. And Rosie, it festered up into quite a scene right before halftime.
Yeah, it was like one of those, you know, those old cartoons where like a dog and a cat pass each other on the street and then they just kind of turn into a big cloud of dust. That's kind of like what that felt like. You know, it was just, there was some, you know, there was some contact, some pushing. There was a little bit of stick swinging that it seemed to, I think that was the element that it seemed
quite
to
yeah.
make the whole crowd a little bit nervous. Because you never want to see, you know, like full on, you know, 12-6 stick swinging. Especially among the helmetless players of
Correct.
The WLL. But so, yeah, there was all of that. And then head coach, Coach Buss, Matty Buss from the California Palms, he steps into the scene it is very funny to hear her describe it, because it basically went down exactly how it looked. She just kind of was like, whoa, hang on, like you might do during an inter squad scrimmage or something like that. Yeah, not practice, the championship right. game, not the biggest game of the career or the league or anything like that. She just, you know, totally kind of said, wait a second, jumped out on the field. And she said she thought she was going for Jill Smith, her player, ends up kind of putting her hands on Kendall Halford, and Halford goes to the ground. And I think you could see in Coach Buss's eyes when Kendall Halford drops to the ground, she's kind of like, whoa, wait, you know, I didn't, what just happened here? So yeah, the whole thing was a very wild scene, but you know, she owned up to it and wasn't mad after the game. You know, she just said, yeah, I can't do that. I can't run out on the field. I gotta not do that. So yeah, no, that was a new one for me. I will say this though, Kendall Halpern, I'm watching her during this series, and I'm not entirely familiar with her game prior. You know, I've since learned a lot more about her and her defensive abilities or whatnot, but not just a good defender. I feel like she's got some Rodman in her, some Draymond Greenish kind of, not in the, you know, physical assaults sort of sense, but in the sense that she always seemed to be right there with the opponents, you know, really making their lives a nightmare. So when Coach Buss got her hands on her, maybe the legs got tangled up, I'm not quite sure, but I think it was at least partially a choice to hit the ground. I'm not sure it was so much her being pushed
Interesting.
She was smiling as soon as she hit the ground. So I think she appreciated the moment. I don't think it was a situation where she was like, whoa, you shoved me, and like angry about it. I think she was more like, what on earth is happening here? Kind of laughing about it.
She had pretty much the game ceiling takeaway ground ball right in the corner close to us in the semifinal. And, you know, Izzy Skein, Doucette, or both just former Northwestern Wildcat teammates just like yelling in celebration. We just avenged the Boston guard this year. Let's go. We're going to the final. And yeah, for her to be in so many of those physical altercations, listen, it's part of the game when you're such a great defender. You're tasked with guarding the Charlotte Norths and the Ali Mascheranis of the world. And like, it's tough to not have like a very nuanced take about, like, you know, all the quote tweets that are just like, oh, it's time to get them in pads. Like, we got to get a WLL player on here and get their take on it, because the indoor world championships were a lot of fun to watch. The World Lacrosse Box Women's Championships up there, that the Team USA did come out on top in. So, yeah, no, it'll be interesting to see how this game continues to evolve. But for now, yeah, Coach Maddie Buss took full accountability, and she was like, listen, I would have... The sideline interviewer asked her right away, like, how about that energy, right? She's like, oh, yeah, it's kind of crazy down here. And then she followed up with, like, yeah, I'll take whatever comes my way. So, like, I turned to you, and I was like, any other league, I think that's, like, you're getting kicked out kind of play. So she got a two-minute flag for the in-house, and... You know, it was great hearing Sam Geiersbach's perspective post game of like, listen, I'm happy that she had her backs first and foremost. And it said more of as a coach of how protective she was rather than like any malicious intent she had for the opposition. And I thought that was very well said. And you saw it in kind of some of the comments that came out on social, like, oh yeah, I was a women's coach and I had to pull my team from the game. one time because they were like, it just got out of hand. And to that point, I think it's like incumbent on the refs to like, listen, if there's like that much stick swinging where they're, as you pointed out, like 12-6 motion,
yeah,
it's time to protect the ladies a little bit. And but yeah, game flow wise, absolutely a takeover from Skein Train with the sock trick, and Emily Hauerstruck just won the Golden Stick last year, came up second along with Skein in the scoring points category with 19 this year, behind Charlotte Norris 22, and she caught fire in the second half to really bring it home for New York. So, like I said it last year, like when you have this much firepower on New York, when you have Skein, Kuykendall, Hauerstruck, Meg Carney looks super explosive all throughout the Champ Series this year, they're going to create some problems for everyone this summer. So, from an actual, like, looking ahead standpoint, Rosie, bring us home with just, like, what you're excited to see and learn more about as these four rosters kind of develop into the final product.
Well, yeah, I can't wait to see what they're going to do as far as the drafts go. And if any holdout players from the Champ Series have, you know, more free schedules that allow them to get back in the game. You know, I don't know the specific reasoning behind certain players' holdouts or lack of availability during these particular 2 weeks. Like, do we see, say, like a Kayla Wood back in the lineup, or is she done? I got no idea what she's up to. But it is sort of really easy for, you know, one elite player to make a huge impact. So, and especially the four-team league, you know, like you've got to be as elite as you have to be, you know, to make, you know, to get drafted, say, by a PLL team. Imagine if there were half as many teams, right? Like they're only going to take the best of the best. So I'm expecting anybody who gets drafted to really hop in and make a big impact. And like I said, with only four, you know, if you're Marilyn Charm, you're picking first, you know, they got to pick first last time and they get Allie Kennedy. You know, imagine you pick first again and pull somebody of, you know, equal caliber to that. That could be a huge shift. You know, I think we saw the Boston Guard were kind of aware that they were going to get everybody's best effort this time around, you know, knowing that they wanted all the time before. And, you know, I think they definitely did. So, you know, we're going to see more of that this time. And, you know, teams understand that they're going to have to take out the guard in order to get to the charging, I think. You know, so if you're say, a Charm fan or something, you know you have your work cut out ahead of you, but you also got to feel pretty good that you keep everybody and are probably going to get some other phenom in there as well. So, yeah, four teams makes it really fascinating. You know, 11 weeks, it's really exciting top to bottom. Really see what they're going to put together, see what their coaches and GMs have to do when they start coaching and GMing the full year. So, yeah, man, I cannot wait to see how this unfolds.
They start on May 16th, 5:30 p.m. in another rematch of last year's Championship Series title game, the Charging and Guard. Like I said, it's the sport's two biggest stars in Izzy Skein and Charlotte North gone head-to-head in this one. You know, you're bringing in some of the Boston fan base, which is important to the league as well, to in that area, in terms of Providence and Rhode Island. So I'm fascinated with Centerville Bank Stadium and how that fills up for the opener. You know, it's one game per weekend. It's eight regular season weekends. They got the All-Star game July 4th weekend on July 5th in Annapolis. So that's going to be some great scenes. And Rosie, what's your take on this? Because they don't play a semifinal. It's a four-team league. So whoever comes out on top in terms of those first two place finishers after the last regular season game Saturday, August 8th in Boston, that's who's playing in the title game in Philadelphia at Subaru Park in Chester, actually. So What's your take on that? You like that in terms of the added value onto the regular season standings?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess it's kind of what you almost have to do. Maybe there's some better or some alternate solutions, but you know, if you got this set time of the year and you have that set league with just four teams, you know, it's probably in a similar sort of way that kind of do the championship series, but stretch it out a little bit. You just kind of say, you know, if you couldn't get it done up till that point, you know, we're not tossing you in the playoffs or something like that. Right. And I think it'll probably end up weeding itself out to get two teams that deserve to be there at the end.
Can't wait to follow it all, Rosie. Thank you for all of you for following all of this podcast. And if you liked it, share it with a friend. Maybe leave a review. Maybe give a 5-star rating. And we'll catch you back next time on the PLL Happy Hour podcast. A very big shout out and special thanks to Austin Cowell for joining the show. And thanks so much for listening. We'll catch you next time.